What's up, y'all? And welcome back to Candid with Carrie. I am your host, Carrie Lippert-Gillespie. I'm so glad that you're here today. It is our first podcast of December of 2021. Like, what? What? Where did 2021 go? I am asking not for a friend, but for myself. I'm not sure where you guys are in the world, but I am coming to you from Kansas City, Missouri in the Midwest. And I had this problem when we were kind of transitioning from summer to fall, but it's still kind of lingering that the weather doesn't know what to be yet. A couple of days ago, in fact, just like literally yesterday, and then the day before yesterday, it was 70 degrees. 70 degrees. It was beautiful, stunning, amazing. I was outside in shorts and a t-shirt walking my dogs. Then today I wake up and it is like winter, full on. It was 30 degrees this morning when I went outside. And I was like, whoa, when did we decide that we were gonna be cold now? It happens so quickly, you guys. And the Midwest is like that girl who cannot decide like who she wants to be. Like she's trying on all these different styles, all these different personas and personalities. Like one day she's emo into like punk rock, and the next day she's like, I don't know, Taylor Swift, like pre-Red era. And it's like, girl, like figure out what you want and then go do it. But like, don't be pulling on our heartstrings here. Like that is what the weather is like in the Midwest. And all of my Wisconsin friends back home who are listening to this are totally rolling their eyes at me because they are always much colder here than we are in Kansas City. And I was born and raised in Wisconsin, lived so much of my life there, and my tolerance for cold goes away so, so quickly. And I know I sound like the biggest turd in Turdville, but it's true, you guys. Like, it's just not something that's fun. They were in single digits today, and my best friend back home, Brianna, and I were texting, and I was telling her how cold I was at 35, and she was like, Carrie, GTFO, like, I do not want to hear it. She was dead serious, like, get out of here with that garbage. And she's right. You know, I needed to hear that. I needed to be told to, like, just shut the hell up. Like, it wasn't working for no one. But I stick by the fact that anything below 50 degrees is just not a place I want to be. The good news is 10 years from now, my beach house in Malibu will be manifesting right before my eyes, but we still have a little ways to go. Until then, we're going to grin and bear it here with the lovely seasons of the Midwest. One thing I'm not complaining about, though, is the fact that because it is December, that means that Christmas movies are running rampant. And you guys know how I got when, you know, Halloween movies were going on. Hocus Pocus was my jam. I was watching it all day, every day. It was like on repeat and I couldn't get enough of it. I love a Christmas movie like 10 times more than I love a Halloween movie. So it's been even worse lately. What are my favorites? I know you want to know, of course. I know you are asking. So I have to say Home Alone and Home Alone 2. Home Alone 2 is arguably one of the movies where the sequel might even have been better than the first one, which is like unheard of, but I stand firm in that. Like, don't come for me. Don't at me. You're not going to change my mind. That is what I feel. Such a good movie. Classic till the day is done. I also have to say, I love me some Clark Griswold, some Christmas Vacation. Like, nothing gets me more holly jolly than Clark Griswold. I love it. I love it. So I have not watched Christmas Vacation yet, but I plan to over and over again. I've watched Home Alone several times. It's actually been on Freeform like every single night, and I have been indulging so, so much. Normally I have friends on during the day for my background noise while I'm working on my computer, but I have switched to Home Alone and I have no regrets. I also really love to throw in like the Santa Claus, Santa Claus 2, Santa Claus 3 is trash, so we're not even going to go there. But Santa Claus 1 and 2 are quality, and I definitely love to have those on in the background. Oh, I love actually. That's a lot of love in one sentence, but it's so true. Again, a classic Christmas movie. I love anything with Hugh Grant. Like, just talk all day long to me, Hugh Grant, and I will listen to you read the phone book in all honesty. Just such a good movie. So many lovable characters, so many wonderful tropes, like just good stuff. I love me a Christmas movie. I am here for it. It's my favorite time of the year. I already love like holiday themed movies in general, but I love Christmas and everything that goes along with it. So I am just on a whole nother level with my TV watching and my Christmas movie consumption. You know, while we're just being real and honest, I'm going to tell you that I still have not started any of my Christmas shopping. And I just don't know what to do. It's one of those things where you get It's like you've gone so far without doing it. You're like, well, I don't even know where to start now. It's like you get overwhelmed with starting because you waited so long. It's one of those weird psychological things that you like cannot break through in your head. I have this theory that I might just get everyone gift cards. I love me a gift card, you guys. My husband says that they're boring, can't do that. Everyone likes to unwrap something. And I'm like, yeah, I'll unwrap me an envelope with money inside that I can use to buy whatever I want. Like, I love getting a gift card. How great is that? You don't have to pretend that it's, you know, to be excited or happy or like, oh, I'm totally going to use this like random whatever that, you know, so-and-so got me. Like, no, it's a gift card. I can do whatever I want with it. Like, who doesn't love a gift card? So I really might go that route. And I don't know one person who was ever disappointed by being like, here's a Target gift card. Go buy whatever the F you want. Like, that's good stuff. So I really think that is going to be my method of choice this year. It's sounding more and more appealing. You know, we got all these supply chain issues, inflation, all these other things going on in the world. Like, why mess with it? Just go get a gift card. Am I wrong? Is that wrong? I don't know. Tell me on Instagram, you guys. Go find my latest post on the Candid with Carrie Instagram page. Comment and tell me gift cards for Christmas, birthdays, whatever. Yay or nay? I mean, am I totally out in left field with this? I don't think so. Let's move it right along to some trending topics of the week. Our first trending topic is that Adele announces her Las Vegas residency. Fans can prepare to say hello. Get it? Hello. It's me. All right, moving on. Fans can prepare to say hello to the superstar starting Friday, January 21st, 2022, at the Coliseum at Caesars Palace for her Weekends with Adele residency. The 30 singer is set to perform two shows each weekend through April 16th, 2022. The Grammy winner's fourth studio album, which debuted at number one on album charts in 30 countries, is already one of the biggest selling albums of 2021. The album's lead single, Easy on Me, topped the charts in over 25 countries in less than 4 weeks since dropping on October 14th. So getting a Vegas residency is like cementing your face on like the Mount Rushmore of like quality acts that stand the test of time. Like, who has had Vegas residencies? Britney, J-Lo, Celine Dion. Like, they don't just give out Vegas residencies to any old person, you know, who happens to land on the charts. Like, this is a huge deal. Good for her. Happy for her. Glad to see it. My problem, or not my problem here, is just my question mark comes in what we are calling a residency nowadays. You know, I always envisioned a residency, and I thought a residency meant that you were a resident, like you were there all the time. This is a weekend residency. I feel like it should be a residency adjacent. Like in Las Vegas, in my mind, when you do a residency, you are doing like five shows a week, maybe. When I went to Vegas, when I was like 19 with my parents or 18 or whatever it was, we went to the Donnie and Marie Osmond show. They had a residency in Vegas. They did shows like 5 days a week, you guys. And they like sold out. It was a great show. Not gonna lie. Didn't know who they were before I walked in the building, of course, but I learned, you know? And so the fact that this is just on the weekends is confusing to me that we're calling it a residency. I'm not sure. Maybe it's residency 2.0. I don't know, but I felt like we give residencies to people who are performing like 5 days a week. It's a, you live there, like the residents, you live there. Like this is like not living there. This is flying in every weekend, doing a show and flying back. Like, I don't know. I'm happy for her. I think this is going to sell like hotcakes. And I'm not surprised she decided to go this route. You know, a lot of people, when they release a brand new album, right after that, they plan a huge like worldwide tour. And it's really exhausting to be on tour, whether it's a nationwide tour or it's a worldwide tour. Like, it's extremely exhausting and it takes a lot out of people. I watched this Shawn Mendes documentary, which I forgot if it was on Netflix or like Amazon Prime. I forgot what it was on. I think it's called Wonder. But he did this humongous tour and he was really transparent that he loves touring. It is like the best thing about what he does. But when you do these things for months on end, it drains you so, so badly. And he was so depleted physically, mentally, spiritually. He lost his voice at one point. Like, it is just so hard on you. And so having this residency kind of in lieu of doing this huge, massive, you know, tour, I'm not surprised that she decided to go this route. She's a mother. She's doing a lot of different things. And like, if you don't have to do it, if you can, if you have a big enough name where you can just plop down in Vegas and have people come to you, like, sure, why not do that? You know, I'm not surprised that she decided to go that route. route. But I guess my surprise is just in the fact that, you know, playing two shows a week is called a residency nowadays. I'm not sure. I think this will sell like hotcakes. Good for her. Happy for her. Adele has been in every one of our stories for the last like month, you guys. She is just doing all the things. So yeah, all over. Good for her. Happy to see it. Shifting gears big time, Alec Baldwin breaks his silence over Rust movie shooting in an interview with George Stephanopoulos. Alec Baldwin broke down in tears remembering cinematographer Helena Hutchins and also recalling the moments before the Rust film set shooting that claimed her life in his first official interview about the tragedy. The sit-down interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos aired Thursday, December 2nd, more than a month after the fatal October 21st incident on the Santa Fe, New Mexico set. During the interview, the 63-year-old actor paid tribute to Hutchins, 42, who is survived by her husband and 9-year-old son. He also said he did not pull the trigger on a gun he was holding during rehearsal for the Western movie. So this aired as like a separate hour-long special on ABC, as I said in the story that I just read. And I sat down and watched the entire thing because I was eager to see what Alec Baldwin would say, you know, in his first official interview. And it was eye-opening and interesting to hear, you know, his thoughts, to hear his recollection of everything, to hear his somewhat unfiltered thoughts. You can't be 100% unfiltered in situations like this because it is an ongoing legal case. There are certain things you can't say. And he did leave some things out and said he wouldn't comment on XYZ thing. But overall, he was very transparent about, you know, from his recollection, how everything went down, walking us through how he felt, how he got word, you know, of what had happened and everything like that. It was alarming to see him. He did not look good, to be quite honest with you. Like, he had massive bags under his eyes. He looked just really disheveled and not good. And, you know, in this case, you don't want to look good. You know, from a PR standpoint, if you come to the interview looking like $1,000, $1,000,000, it doesn't look good. Like, so I've definitely seen him look better. I'm not surprised that he looked so disheveled and so upset. He's been through a lot emotionally, but I also think that, like, from a PR standpoint, like, you can't go into this interview looking the best you've ever looked. And he definitely did not. He broke down and cried several times. And I am not a good judge of, like, oh, were these real tears or not? He is an actor, blah, 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 all this other stuff. Like, I would think when a woman's life has been lost, the goal is not to, like, quote unquote, be an actor in the interview afterwards. Like, and yes, he is an actor. And I don't know if his tears were real. He looked genuinely upset. I don't know how you could, like, be involved in this, be a human, and not be genuinely upset. So I do take all of his emotions and all of his tears and everything he went through as genuine, just because I don't think he's a sociopath that would, like, try and put on a show after being involved in such a horrific and, like, just horrible thing. I just don't think that any sane person would be able to do that or want to do that. In terms of his recollection of what happened and his quote of saying that he did not pull the trigger, he was doing something. I am not an actor. I do not know the terms for it, but where he was doing something where he is being set up with the cinematographer. The cinematographer, who was Helena Hutchins, needed a certain shot of him pointing the gun. Like, they needed a certain shot of him holding the gun. And so this was not when they were actively, like, going through lines. It was like a setup for them to get the shot, for her to know where to get the shot when they were rolling, when they were doing other things and whatnot. And she was coaching him on where to have the gun. There were a lot of people saying, why would you ever point a gun at someone, blah, 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 blah. According to his recollection, he was being coached by her. She needed him to point the gun at the camera where she was because she was trying to get a shot. So he was pointing the gun at the camera where she was because she was coaching him to line up a shot. He says that he cocked the revolver. You know, if you know what a revolver is, you know that there's like a lever on the back that you cock with your thumb, and that puts, you know, a bullet in the chamber. Now, that being said, this was a set and there should not have been any bullets in this chamber. Or if there were bullets, they should have been, you know, not real bullets. They're not bullets. They're like a dry, you know, they're a fake thing. They're a blank or whatever they call it. And so he cocked the gun like she needed him to for this scene. And he said that immediately after he cocked it, he released it and the gun went off. He said he never pulled the trigger. He cocked the gun and then immediately it just went off. And his thing was that A, he never pulled the trigger, and B, He doesn't know how there were live rounds put into that gun in the first place, because on a set like that, you just don't, you don't need live rounds. You really don't. You have blanks, or you have, you know, fake things that make noise, and but they don't shoot anything out. Like, you just get the motion of the gun and the noise, but it doesn't shoot anything out. Those are things that people use for movie sets. And his thing is that, you know, there is someone on all of these sets, someone called an armorer, that it is their specific job each time to make sure people are trained with the guns, and that all of the guns are, and all the explosives or anything like that that could be dangerous, are handled properly. Like, that is their one job, the armorer on the set, is to make sure that everything is stored, everything is set up, everything is where it's supposed to be. And that obviously wasn't done on this set. There was some controversy about things on the set. I think they were saying that the original person who was supposed to be the armorer on this movie, like, quit last minute, so they needed to bring someone else in. Like, there was all these, like, there's all this minutia about what was going on. And I just think that there was a lack of attention to detail. Regardless, it's just, how did real bullets get into this gun on the set? I'm not sure. That seems to be where the, you know, investigation lies, where the legal action lies, is that why are there bullets in this gun in the first place? This is a set. This is a prop. This is not a place where real bullets are needed. And I don't think that Alec Baldwin, you know, from what I'm hearing in this point of view, I don't think that he's totally, you know, completely to blame. Could he have checked? Yes, but it really isn't his job. You know, he is at the mercy of someone else doing their job. We are all at the mercy at times of someone else doing their job so that we can do our job. And that's kind of what it sounds like in this situation. Could he have checked? Yes, he could have checked. But would he have known the difference? Would he have seen, like, the real round as different from the fake? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. But as I just said, I feel like a lot of times in a movie, in show business, and even what I do, like, as a host, like, I am at the mercy of someone else doing their job so that I can do mine. And sometimes it looks like, you know, I'm the person on air, and if something goes to shit, you know, it looks like I don't have my stuff together. But in reality, it could be someone else didn't do their job. But because I'm the one on air, I'm taking the fall for it. I think it's the same in this situation. It's just, it's a horrible thing. This poor woman, it's sad, without a doubt. I feel horrible for the situation. I feel horrible for the family, for the husband and the son, of course. It's just, it's sad. I don't know any other way to chop it. And I feel bad for Alec Baldwin. George Stephanopoulos, you know, asked him, are you going to go back to acting? And he said he didn't know. He says he has another movie, you know, that he had lined up for January. And he's like, I don't know if it's worth it for me to go back to acting. I don't know if I can. I don't know if I will. Like, he doesn't need more money. He got enough money at this point. Like, I don't know if I'll go back to acting. That's what he said. And I don't blame him. It's just such a sad situation. I hope we as a society learn from this. I hope show business in general learns from this. And I hope that they have new rules and new regulations that they put in place so that this never happens again. It's just so sad. Taking a major pivot to our next story, Cardi B makes history by being named Playboy's first ever creative director in residence. The rapper announced that she has secured another bag and added a role at Playboy to her resume, serving as creative director in residence. Quote, "Ya girl is the first ever creative director in residence at Playboy," she tweeted on December 2nd. Quote, "What a dream. I'm getting the party started as the founding creative and a founding member of Centerfold, the new creative-led platform by Playboy. I am so excited for everything that's to come," end quote. In an official statement, the rapper added, quote, "For as long as I can remember, I have felt connected to Playboy. It's truly the original platform for uncensored creativity, and I'm inspired by its incredible legacy of fighting for personal freedoms. I have so many ideas already. I can't wait," end quote. Playboy celebrated the new addition to the team with a tweet referencing one of the Grammy winner's best lines. Quote, "I run this shit like cardio," read the message from the magazine's social media account. "Today is a Playboy milestone. We couldn't be more excited and honored to welcome our first ever creative director in residence, the icon at I Am Cardi B," end quote. All right, y'all. Let's talk about something on brand. That is for sure. Wow. Cardi is just a woman who is 100% herself, and I like women who do that. That's for sure. She just came off the heels of hosting the American Music Awards, which I talked about last week. I think she nailed it there. And she's known for her personality, for being loud and proud and out there. And she is also known for being very vocal about her career as a stripper before she got famous as a rapper. So this is just really in line with her brand. Honestly, like, I think there's so many celebrities who do things nowadays that aren't necessarily in line with like the persona they put out there. And it's kind of a question mark to people, but the money is good. So they stick their name on it. Like, this is totally in line with Cardi. That's for sure. In terms of what this platform is, this centerfold platform, honestly, it sounds very much similar, like a knockoff of OnlyFans, to be quite honest. So I read an article and this is what it said. The focus of Centerfold, which is set to launch later this month, is to provide influential creators with unique ways to interact with their followers and supporters. So, I mean, I don't know. You take that for what you think. But to me, that sounds like an OnlyFans like ripoff kind of or Playboy's version of OnlyFans. Now, if you are not a frequent Playboy consumer, it is to be noted that it no longer prints in physical form. They have an online version, I am nearly positive, but they stopped printing in physical form back in March of 2020. You know, it was said that it had to do with supply chain issues because of the coronavirus pandemic. I really think that it's just like that the coronavirus pandemic was a scapegoat for them to stop printing. I think they were losing money hand over fist. Like most magazines these days that print in physical form, they lose money. Like everything is so digital these days. So I think that was just a good way for them to stop printing. They do have an online presence and it looks like they are trying to diversify with this new creative app and what they're going to do there. So it no longer prints in magazine form. In terms of what her being the creative director in residence for this new platform will entail, we will have to see because I really do not know. And we'll probably have to see till the platform comes out and how she will go forward with it. I'm not sure. This is going to be a platform where people have pages or profiles or what have you, or they subscribe. I'm not even sure what it's going to be. But in terms of like her putting her name on this and her partnering with them, like it's a great match, honestly. Like 10 out of 10, totally on brand for her. I am curious what the payday is like, quite honestly, because I'm sure that she got a pretty penny to do this. All right, y'all, that is going to wrap up our trending topics of the week. Those definitely ran the gamut of all sorts of things, that is for sure. Let's move it right along to our interview portion of the show. This week's guest is Natalie Brunell. Natalie is a TV correspondent, an Emmy award-winning journalist, and podcaster. She is originally a Midwest girl who grew up in Chicago, and actually we find out in this episode as I'm interviewing her that we are both of Polish descent, and she talks about growing up, you know, as a Polish girl in Chicago, and it was funny to hear her say that because my mom is 100% Polish, and so all of my cousins on my mom's side of the family, her cousins are all Polish Chicagoans too, so it was funny to learn that in real time and to bond with her over our shared Polish heritage. She eventually made her way out to the West Coast, where she started her career in journalism, working for local news in Palm Springs, California, and then eventually working her way up to being a national freelance correspondent for ABC News. She spent a lot of her freelance career covering these really impactful events, shootings, wildfires, hurricanes, all sorts of things that really were heavy and at times hard to cover, and you had to be ready at a moment's notice to just get the call and go cover them. Eventually, she got to the point where the schedule and the hours were really tough on her, and she just couldn't see herself continuing on the path. So she decided to really pivot her career. It was also around this time that she discovered a little something called Bitcoin and decided that she wanted to pivot her career. There were so many parts of this interview that were so, so fun for me. I absolutely loved hearing about her experience in investigative journalism. It is just a version of journalism that is not for the faint of heart. And she told us a really, really great story about her time in Palm Springs and how she really cracked a story wide open. I loved hearing about how she first discovered Bitcoin and how she decided to really immerse herself in it and become an expert in it, quite frankly. And on a personal level, I just feel like it is so refreshing to see a female in the finance space who knows her stuff and is actively working to share that information with other people, especially other females in the world today. This is a good one, you guys. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Natalie Brunell. Natalie, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to chat with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to get to know you a bit better.
Yes. Okay. So I always start out with the first question, which is tell us where you grew up and what you were like as a child.
Sure. So I have an immigration story as my background. I was born in Poland, and I don't really remember a lot from my young life there because I was very little when we immigrated to the US. I do remember that we traveled a lot across Europe because my parents were importing and exporting merchandise, and they had this little shop. And so we would travel to what was then Yugoslavia and Bulgaria and different countries near Poland. So that was interesting. We sometimes traveled in a big RV. And it's really funny because I was always either getting sick or injuring myself as a kid. I was such a klutz. One time I remember I put my hand on like a stove or something that was like heating up our food, and there was like a coil spring or whatever. And it was really hot and I didn't know. And I placed my whole hand on it, burned off my hand. I think I knocked a tooth out at one point. I mean, I was always just something was happening. So I think my parents were not super big fans of taking me anywhere. But yeah, we moved to the US when I was 5. We moved outside of Chicago. And a lot of people don't know this, but Chicago has the second largest Polish population outside of the capital of Poland, Warsaw. So a lot of Polish people in the community. And then my parents moved us to a very nice suburb, and I went to high school there and grew up in a beautiful area. We sort of had probably the least of all the families. We went to that suburb because my mom wanted us to go to really good schools, my brother and me, but we definitely were the family that had the least. Like, we lived in the smallest apartment, and all my friends had really nice houses, and their families did really well. So I think it was at that point that I started to think, wow, you know, I really want to achieve the American dream. Like, that's what my parents set out for. I want to be able to have a nice house like this for my family someday. I pretty much, you know, grew up in apartments, and I just really wanted to grow up and be successful because I felt like I wanted to make sure that my family someday had a comfortable life. But, you know, my parents were so loving, super supportive of what I wanted to do. And I had a great childhood. I was really lucky.
It's so funny you mention Chicago and the Polish population, because my mom is 100% Polish. And so I have like a Polak family, and she is like so proud of her Polish heritage. And all of my like cousins, all of her cousins live in the Chicago suburbs. I mean, as soon as you said that, I'm like, she's a Chicago Polak, and I know that so well.
I know, it's so true. I even changed my name. So it was really funny, you know, assimilating here from a different country, you just don't want to feel different. Mm-hmm. So my birth name is Natalia. So my parents still call me Natalia or Natalka, but I changed it to Natalie because that was what the kids called me. And they were like, no, the American version is Natalie. And so I was Natalie, but that's not really my name.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Excuse my dogs over there. The neighbor dogs walk by all the time and they play through the door. So did your family change their last name? Because my mom's family, they Americanized their last name. They were Tomczyk. So it was Tomszyck. And they Americanized it. They changed the Z to an S. And it's still pretty Polish. But I mean, they specifically did that when they came here.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting question. And I changed my last name when I was in school becoming a broadcast journalist, because you're right. I mean, the names that are Polish are very hard to pronounce. They're very difficult to spell. And so I personally, for just privacy, I don't share what my family's last name is. But yes, I changed my last name when I was in college. I went through the whole formal process. And it was funny because I actually had a professor who recommended it. She was like, you know, the easier your name is to pronounce, especially on camera, it's just going to be easier for your job and your career. And it will make you a little bit more appealing to a broader audience, right? As opposed to just like being one finite nationality at the time. Like, it was great to appeal to more and more people. And so yeah, I remember that process. And I remember also being worried that my parents were going to get mad. And I went to them, and my mom was like, oh no, like if I could have a name that's easier to pronounce, I would have done it. So a lot of people don't realize that about me, or at least don't even ask. But yeah, it was, I changed my last name from my original Polish last name.
That's so cool. Like, I don't want to go off on like too big of a tangent here, but like, how do you go about picking a new last name? Like, that's so fun.
Yeah. So I really wanted it to be similar to my last name. I looked at my family's names and it was funny because originally I was like, well, maybe I'll just go with like a maiden name or just something within the family lineage that's easy to pronounce. And there really weren't any. So they're all just so complicated. So I basically like shortened and finagled something. And, you know, I actually lived for part of the time in Italy and when I was in college, and Italy had just such an impact on me. And so Brunel also had kind of significance in Italian. So I sort of, I like blended things together. I wanted to make sure that there was the same first initial, and I officially changed it, like legally changed it and all that. So
that is so cool to me and fascinating. When did you like know you wanted to be a journalist, or maybe it took you a little while to get there? Walk us through kind of your process of deciding that you wanted to be in news and be a journalist.
Yeah. So growing up outside Chicago, again, I had a really, really great lifestyle, even though my family did not have the means that some of my friends and peers did. And we watched a lot of television and movies when I was growing up. My parents both worked really hard. And then when we came home at night, the news was always on, or we would watch movies. And so I felt like I started to see my life through a four-angled lens. You know, I would play make-believe a lot. I did acting classes, and I just always loved interviews. I loved Barbara Walters, and I would watch all the news programs that my mom was really into. And I thought, what an amazing career, right? You get to travel and meet really important figures, and you're constantly learning, and it felt like you have impact on the community or influence. So I was really drawn to the idea of just being in media in general. And a part of me at one point thought I wanted to be an actress, but really was always, I think, news and storytelling that drew me even more, or documentaries and travel hosting, all of that. So I decided very early on I was going to set my sights on Los Angeles for college, because I kind of assumed that that was the world of media and that's where all of it was centered, even though for news, actually probably New York would have been the better idea. But, you know, at the time you're little, you're growing up, and you think that everything's sort of made in Hollywood or around it. So I only looked at Los Angeles schools. And I remember I did like a summer program at UCLA, and I thought, this school's too big, I don't want to go here. I got into an honors program at USC, but I actually decided on Pepperdine because it was smaller, it was religious, and I just thought the campus was beautiful. And I thought that I would get great opportunities to work on camera there doing video work and news stuff much earlier than I would at a much bigger school. So for those and many other reasons, I chose to go to Pepperdine and study broadcast journalism.
Wow. I think subconsciously, maybe you were like sick of like the Midwest cold and you were like, I'm going to LA.
Yeah, I will say growing up in the cold is something I don't miss. I mean, Chicago's extreme, right? Like there are other places that have the beautiful seasons, but Chicago is intense. Like I remember not wanting to get out of bed to just make the walk to the shower because it's so freezing cold. And my parents would have to, okay, if you have means, you have a garage, right? So like the car doesn't get hit with snow. Well, we didn't have that luxury. We were at an apartment where all the cars are exposed. And so my dad would be out at like 3 o'clock in the morning, turning the car on to heat it up. And like, he would have two keys. So like the one key would stay inside the car, and then he would take the other key, lock the car while it was on to like melt off the ice. And then he would go scrape the rest of the ice off. And I was like, oh my God. First of all, I don't want to live in this climate. And second of all, I want money to have a garage.
Yeah. So you took your talents out west, and you were like, I'm going to see what it's all about there. Tell us about your first job once you got out of college, or, you know, even before that, did you have any internships that really left an impact on you?
Yeah. You know, it's crazy to look back at my college career. I was very ambitious. You know, I had this, I think, immigrant mentality. I was always a really big hard worker. I worked while I was in high school as well. So in college, I did an internship at a news program here in Los Angeles, but I also spent half of my college career in Italy. I added a second major. I actually created the Italian major at Pepperdine. I was the first student to graduate with it. And I worked at a television station in Italy, and I did bilingual programming about things to do in Tuscany, which was really fun. And at the time I was like, I'm going to be the next like travel host. I'm going to be Anthony Bourdain or Samantha Brown. And then my junior into senior year, the financial crisis happened, and literally the world world, you know, stopped dead in its tracks and no one could get jobs. And I graduated right into a recession, which was so challenging and so, so difficult. Because literally not only was no one hiring, but the people who were, the jobs were like paying less than my high school internships. And it was just really, really scary. And at the time, I was actually really confused about what to do and how to navigate the industry. And I didn't know how you become a travel host, essentially. So I ended up going for a year to work at a big talent agency in Los Angeles called CAA, where I learned a lot about the behind the scenes of just how media, how television, how movies work, how the financing works. And it was a really interesting like blip on my career. And then I actually went to grad school. So I went back home to Chicago and I attended journalism school at Medill. I got my master's in journalism. And after that is when I set off on my career. So I got my first job behind the scenes at CNN. And from there, I got my first on-camera job in news, which was in Palm Springs, California. And then I like worked my way up from there.
Yeah, I actually listened to another episode that you did on another podcast. I forgot what the name of it was, but a gentleman was interviewing you and you had this crazy story about like uncovering this massive thing with the mayor in Palm Springs. And I was blown away by what you had kind of uncovered. It was amazing.
Yeah, that was a really formative point in my career as a journalist, because again, I was kind of brand new out of grad school navigating. I mean, the industry, people look at it as so glamorous and it's not. You literally start out with a job that pays, if you're lucky, $30,000 a year in a small town. I got lucky in the sense that I started somewhere that's very beautiful and livable, which is the Palm Springs market. It's not that big. It's very small in the backyard of Los Angeles, but the depth and breadth of stories that you get to cover there are amazing. And the station, I worked at the top station there. So we got to go live every single day. I mean, that's why I feel comfortable in front of a camera, because I went from basically, you know, no experience or just, you know, school pretend, you know, make-believe newscast to, you know, you're live at 5, 5:30, 6, 6:30, 10 and 11. And you are just like on it. And I became the station's investigative reporter. I think I've always had a knack for digging and I've always been really curious and I always want to hold powerful people accountable, because I see sort of how the system kind of screwed my parents. I see my parents as sort of the little guy that I want to protect and I want to hold the powers that be accountable. So I started to chase the mayor because the mayor had this relationship with a developer that turned out to be, you know, basically it was like pay to play. He was accepting money from the developer in this shell company that was a consulting job. Meanwhile, he's approving projects for that developer in the city. And it was just so brazen and ridiculous. And all you had to do was pull the right paperwork and we exposed this whole thing. So it took a long time. I did so many reports on it. I learned so much about our government system and the type of filings that you need to make to uncover certain things about politicians. And when I left, actually, was when the trial or the, you know, the legal components came in, and that mayor was indicted on more than 30 counts of public corruption. And some of my reporting had, you know, had contributed to that, I think. So it's amazing.
Absolutely incredible. The story to hear you tell it was incredible. And what I want everyone listening to also get from this that you're leaving out is that you got that scoop and you were able to get that because you, some woman was there at a city meeting and you could tell that she had something to say and you offered to take her out for a cup of coffee and listen to her because she had information that, you know, sometimes when you're a regular person, you can't, what you're saying doesn't carry as much weight, but you were a person with a camera and that carries some weight. So, I mean, you really uncovered this by your hard work and your willingness to like go the extra mile.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I share that with my students. Now I teach journalism at USC and I tell them that you have to be really tenacious. And sometimes I think TV reporters don't have the best reputation. They're seen as like the people that just want to be in front of the camera, and it's the newspaper reporters that are the real journalists. And I it was the biggest compliment to me when I left that market, because the newspaper reporters wrote to me saying like, you gave us a run for our money. You like were a really good reporter. But basically what I did is I was sent to cover a council meeting, and there was this woman who she really wanted to have her moment on stage to you know, say something to the mayor, and no one was really hearing her out. And everyone just thought she was kind of that, you know, that crazy person that talks at the council meeting that no one really cares what they have to say. And I pulled her aside because there's something about it that just made me curious. And I thought maybe this is a dead end, but you know, maybe she has something to say. And she, it turned out it was a lucky coffee date, because she was like, I've been pulling these documents and reporting things to the FBI for the last couple of years. Like, if you're interested, I'll point you in the right direction. And so she ended up being my main primary source. And she had already been talking to the FBI, and lo and behold, about 6 months later, the FBI raided City Hall, and I was the, you know, one of the first people there.
So incredible. And I think that's, especially if you want to be in investigative journalism, like the investigative part is huge. And you have to, I mean, you got to be ethical. You have to play by certain rules and whatnot, but taking someone out for a cup of coffee and just saying, hey, I can tell you have something to say. I'm here to listen. Like that's totally within bounds. And it led to you getting to the bottom of that story, which is absolutely incredible.
Totally. Sources are so important, being kind to sources and just like following the trail. And sometimes you just need to know what that trail is or where to look. And you can, you know, papers, especially public documents, they can tell a real story, and like no one can argue with facts and public documents.
Yeah. Where was your next stop after Palm Springs?
So I think it was that story actually that was the driver and the catalyst for me being able to jump a lot of markets. So I went from market 146 or 8, which was Palm Springs, to market 20, which was Sacramento, the state capital. And it was funny because at the time I was really struggling with my decision, because I also had an opportunity that would allow me to anchor, but in a smaller market. So it was either, I think, Fresno at the time or Sacramento. They're not even that far away from each other. One was a small market, 55 or 60, and the other was 20. And I was like, you know what? I have the opportunity to be in the state capital, the state of California, you know, the fifth largest, I think, economy in the world. I want to go. I want to see what that's like. And I think that had I not gone to Sacramento, I might not have even heard about Bitcoin, because I ended up going to Sacramento and I was covering a little bit of everything, but I ended up meeting someone who became my boyfriend. He was living in San Francisco and his friends were in the crypto space. They had Bitcoin. Some of them had lost money in Mt. Gox, but they were very involved in the space. One of them worked at Coinbase. And so I was first exposed to that concept and that technology while I was in Sacramento, but dating someone in San Francisco. So, you know, I think everything happens for a reason. I'm no longer with that person, but he was the first person that led me down that Bitcoin path. So I worked in Sacramento for the next 2 years.
Wow. Yeah. Incredible. Anytime you can be in a state capital, I feel like, especially if it's very vibrant, it's an opportunity, not to mention just from the fact that like all the laws are being made there and there's a lot of stuff going on. So yeah, that sounds like it was a fun opportunity for you. When did you get the gig being a freelance correspondent with ABC out of Los Angeles? Because that is a crazy gig to get.
Yeah, so it was after Sacramento. I sort of set my sights once again on Los Angeles. For me, I always wanted to get back there. It was just a goal for me. I think some people, you know, envision going back to Chicago if that's their home, or maybe New York City or something. I always did want to get to network, but I always wanted to first go to LA, because that's where I spent my college career and a little bit of time in my early life after college. So my goal was Los Angeles, and I was fortunate enough to be introduced to one of the VPs of talent. I went in for an interview. They needed a freelance correspondent that was based out of the Los Angeles Bureau. And so, right after I moved down to Sacramento from Sacramento, I started freelancing for ABC News. I had the chance to travel across the country covering breaking news. It was a very eye-opening experience, because I think you have one vision in your head of what it's like to be a national correspondent, and the reality is actually a little bit different, kind of going back to what I said about how it's not a glamorous job at all. But, you know, I got to cover some of the biggest stories facing the nation during that time. Barbara Bush's funeral. I covered several mass shootings, as you can imagine. They're constantly in the headlines. Covered Hurricane Florence, which was supposed to come in as this historic Category 5. I covered all the massive wildfires, the historic deadly wildfires in California. So I was all over the place, and it was a really, really eye-opening, amazing experience, but I didn't want to continue down that path.
I want to ask you real quick how you care for yourself when you're covering such heavy things. All the things that you covered are, again, yeah, monumental. I remember all those things happening, but they're all really heavy topics, from the hurricane to someone's, you know, a big, important person in our country's history, their funeral, to also, you know, the wildfires, things like that. How do you care for yourself in a way that, because part of me thinks I'd be really sad a lot of the time, and you kind of have to navigate it so that you can do your job and separate it. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. It's a challenge. And I think everyone kind of processes it in a different way. I would say that there's been so many stories where it's really hard. And especially when you see the same tragic thing happening, whether it's, you know, a shooting like with the schools that we've seen in our country, or just in general, you know, we're always covering crime. You know, news does not cover necessarily the happiest things going on in the community. It's always very difficult. So I think part of it is just training, right? The more that you do something, the more that you're comfortable and the more that you know how to handle the situation and you don't get as emotionally impacted. But the second thing is you also don't want to lose that human impact. So for me, you know, I was raised to always be very mindful of just the human experience and like right and wrong and treating people the right way. And so I would just always put myself in the shoes of the person that I was trying to interview, because it's not an easy thing to agree to especially an on-camera interview with someone. You're really trusting a lot to them, especially nowadays with how crazy things are in the media and how skewed everything can get. And so I just always try to bring myself down to that human level of remembering that this is someone's family member, this is someone's friend, this is someone's parent, this is someone's loved one, this is someone's daughter, son. And that's the best way to kind of just stay grounded. But you know, you are trained, you know what to do in that situation, and you're kind of under the gun, just trying to meet your deadline and making sure that you write a good story and you convey the message that you need to convey. And you have a team around you at that point that can help. So, you know, I think it just takes time and practice, but I think that people shouldn't lose the most important aspect of the industry, which is that human connection, because that's what makes people feel and remember your story, is when you aim for someone's heart. So.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's really good advice. Tell us some about, you know, you kind of talked about Bitcoin a little bit, but I mean, you're Miss Bitcoin to me. Like you got like the Bitcoin cover, especially from like the female perspective. I don't hear a lot of females talking about Bitcoin. I see a lot of, no offense, but like old white guys talking about it, or young, like 25-year-old, like I'm an entrepreneur, like white guys talking about it, which is great. But the fact that you're a female talking about it is so impressive. So tell us how, you know, you told us how you kind of stumbled into it, but how did you decide to like really make it your expertise?
Yeah, no, I love that you said that. You know, it's very, your observation is right. There are not a lot of women in this space, and I think Bitcoin really needs a woman's touch. So hopefully I'm helping in that arena. But basically, so when I heard about it, I was probably like most people, and I was very skeptical. I was like, what is this thing? It's probably some scam or, you know, online funny money. I don't gamble. I'm pretty risk averse, actually, because I'm pretty conservative. And my background being my family being immigrants and seeing them lose everything in the crash, I just never wanted to gamble with my money. And I was always a really big saver. But what was interesting is when I went down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, I learned a lot about economics and our monetary system. And I realized that I was basically doing what most people are doing. I was trying to save my way to wealth, which doesn't work. You can't just put your money in the bank and expect for it to have the same purchasing power, even just a year later. And the reason for that is some of the things that are going wrong at a government level, from the Federal Reserve to money printing to inflation and quantitative easing and all these terms that I didn't learn when I was younger. So Bitcoin, I'm really grateful for, because it sparked that interest in me to gain knowledge about how our system is fundamentally broken and why there seems to be money that sort of pools at the top with a very small percentage of people. And the rest of us and a lot of my peers, like we're working harder than ever, you know, we're trying to make it and be power bosses. And, you know, we're, you know, hoping for that raise, and everything just seems to be getting so much more expensive around us that it's like we're on this hamster wheel and we can never keep up. And that the goalpost keeps moving of when you're finally going to be secure. Well, maybe next year, maybe my next job. And it's like, why does it have to be this way? And why is it like this in the first place? So Bitcoin really taught me a lot about our system and about money and how to think about money. And just this idea that we don't have to have money that loses value. We can have something through amazing technology that can actually allow us to accumulate wealth for our families and allow us to put our money into a place that, yes, it's volatile in the short term, but over the long term just grows and grows and grows because it's a fixed supply and no one can manipulate it. There's no corporation or government behind it. And so I was really empowered by that because, you know, I really believe in the American dream. I believe that if you come here or if you're born here and you're a good person and you work hard and you just want to do the right thing and for your family and make your life better or your kids' lives better than what you had, you should be able to do that. And it shouldn't be that hard. And you should be allowed to like innovate and be able to save your money. So Bitcoin really spoke to me on very deep levels. And I just decided that I could do more work kind of educating people on Bitcoin and also our monetary system than I was doing in news. You know, after 10 years, you've really covered everything, not just twice, three times, but 20 times. And it's been a wonderful experience. And I've learned so much, but now I want to use those skills of being a reporter and a messenger and a synthesizer of complicated, you know, issues and use it to help promote the idea of Bitcoin and sound money and a technology that will allow people to save into the future. So I'm really passionate about that because I think it could help a lot of people during a very broken, divisive time.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. And it sounds like the path that you were on, it's kind of like, I think everyone gets to this point in their career where, in fact, I had a friend who just told me this exact thing. She's like, I got to the point in my career where I was like, do I want my boss's job? Because at this rate, the next step for me is my boss's job. And in your case, it would have been maybe being an anchor or whatever. And she's like, I didn't want his job. And she's like, that's when I knew I had to make a change because this could be, I could just kind of float around. But if I really don't want his job, then I'm really not going anywhere. So maybe I need to, you know, shift and do something different. And I think that's so powerful. It sounds like you said, if you really didn't like have it in you to be like, yeah, I want to anchor like World News Tonight, then like, yeah, like I can still be in TV, but like maybe I should shift and see if I can take these skills to another avenue.
Yeah, that's a really great point because I think two things happen. Number one, the ABC News experience was a very eye-opening one because all of the people who are on these amazing big networks, their life as a field correspondent is very physically intensive. I mean, I had to have my phone next to me at night, you know, with a bag in my car ready to go to the airport at a moment's notice because a tragedy, a natural disaster, just something can literally hit out of nowhere, right? You can't predict these things. And there's something happening in all cities all across, you know, America at any given time. So it was this very, it was a very stressful state to live in because you're constantly waiting for the next disaster or tragedy, which some people I think get such an adrenaline rush out of. And I think in my 20s, I was more like that. I was the girl that wanted to be the first on the scene at breaking news. But as I got into my 30s and I started to reprioritize things in my life, I actually saw that as a very difficult to maintain lifestyle. Like it was something that I didn't think was sustainable. And I saw the women who had become moms and were still trying to keep up with that schedule. And, you know, when you're on the scene of breaking news, I mean, you're not getting sleep. I was maybe sleeping like 2 hours a night on some of these stories, trying to like put my makeup on in the dark, you know, just to be on live shot after live shot after live shot. It was very, very difficult. And I think I just had that moment in me where I just looked at the next 5-10 years of my life and I didn't see that picture. And I thought, well, where can I serve better? And I remembered being very happy as an investigative reporter because I just love digging deeper and doing really meaningful work that could have an impact on the community and again, holding people accountable. So I went back down to a local level and I finished my sort of news career at a place called Spectrum News here in Los Angeles, which was wonderful. And I got to do some great investigative reporting. But by that time, while I was at ABC News, I actually launched a podcast and I really loved the podcast format, which I'm sure this is why you have one, because it's long form. You don't have to cut it down and clip it down to the best, you know, sound bite that will air for a couple seconds. You get to have a real conversation and get to know someone and learn something and put that out there sort of in a little capsule for people to digest. So I decided to pivot my podcast from interviewing people within media and social media and news to just Bitcoin because I was so fascinated with the space. And basically that changed the trajectory of my future because it took off. There's a growing audience and need in the space, especially for simplifying the message. And so I basically went from being this local reporter with a podcast on the side to being able to actually just go off on my own entirely, which was really, really rewarding.
Yeah. And actually you mentioned your first podcast, Career Stories, is how I found you. You must have been interviewing someone that I followed and they posted on their stories, but I saw it and I listened to it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was Carissa Kullner, one of the E! News girls I know you interviewed. And I listened to the podcast and I liked it. And I continued to listen to your show. And I liked hearing from other media people. And now I have a podcast where I interview media people, but that's really where I stumbled upon you. And I followed you on Instagram and I stayed, you know, up with what you were doing. And when I saw that you were doing your Bitcoin podcast, I'm like, I noticed that you were shifting into the other mode, but I was happy to see that you obviously were so on fire for it, first of all. So I was excited for that and happy for that. And again, it was just good to see a female. It's always good to see a female in the like wealth or the money or the investment like lane. But the fact that you were a female really honing in on Bitcoin, I thought was so impressive. And I'm just so happy for all the success you've had with it. That's great.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And I love when people just go after what they're passionate about. So, you know, congratulations on your show too. And thank you for finding mine. I really appreciate it. And I think women need to support each other. So, you know, anything I can do, let me know.
Yes. Heck yes. Always. I want to know if someone is really just starting on Bitcoin, because I'm going to be honest with you, I'm going to let it fly. It overwhelms me a lot. Like, I don't know where to start. I'm sure you hear this a lot. If I want to educate myself on Bitcoin or just on building wealth for my family or whatever it is, where should I start? My first thought I always tell people is like, go YouTube something, go Google something, but you got to be careful because anything could be on the internet these days. So is there a book you recommend or I mean, your podcast, obviously, but to really just understand the basics and the fundamentals?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I will say the first thing too is Bitcoin, I think, is intimidating for people because the price looks so unattainable, especially right now, right? It's like, oh my gosh, $50,000, $60,000. Like, how do you afford a whole coin? First, I just want to make the point that you don't have to have a full coin. People need to start looking at this as like a savings account in the way they look at their 401k. It's literally designed to be a savings technology and a form of digital property, like digital real estate. And so I really recommend and urge people to buy even just like a dollar's worth, like $1. You can buy $1 worth of Bitcoin. But I say that because it starts to get you to pay attention, right? So all of a sudden now with even a dollar or $5, you're sort of invested and you have a place where you want to check and you're now going to start looking at the price. And so I think that that's just one little baby step where you're going to be more engaged if you're actually using something. And again, this is a technology, so you have to use it in order to understand it. The second thing I would say is the book that changed my life and caused me to really go down this path is something called The Bitcoin Standard. It's by Saifedean Ammous. Whether you read it on a Kindle or on a paperback or audio version, I'm telling you, it is the best book I've ever read, not just within Bitcoin, but just in general. It's my favorite book because I'm someone who was always aware of money, right? Like I grew up not having much and I always knew I wanted to become successful, but I never understood how money worked or the history of money. So the book is kind of a misnomer because it's actually not really about Bitcoin until the last two chapters. It's about the history of our money system. And it's fascinating. It will expose you to ideas and thoughts that you've never had before and historical statistics that will really, really change your viewpoint on a lot of things. So the first thing I would say is read The Bitcoin Standard. There are lots of other books out there, but The Bitcoin Standard is really like the Bible. And the reason that I wanted to do my podcast, so I hope people find, you know, this interesting, is now I know about Bitcoin. Now I understand it. Now I've read this book. Well, I saw this huge amount, this space with these really massive leaders, these thought leaders, these guys with massive followings. Most of them are guys. And a lot of them came from really successful backgrounds and careers in the past. They're smart. They made a ton of money. And all of a sudden, they have this huge conviction for Bitcoin. And I wanted to know how they got there. So literally it was like Career Stories. If you know my podcast before, it's very similar to how I built this with Guy Raz, where I start at the beginning and I'm like, who are you? How'd you get to be where you are? And why do you believe in what you believe? That's what I did for Bitcoin. I started with all the people that I could find in the space who I followed and I looked up to. I'm like, who the heck are you? Like, let's start from the very beginning. How did you build your career? How did you become, you know, a multi-million dollar investment, whatever? And how did you discover Bitcoin? And what was it about Bitcoin that, you know, you found fascinating or you found, you know, would solve all these problems that we're facing? And it's funny because I experienced a transformation where as I did these interviews, I just became more and more convicted. I mean, you can't talk to a bunch of these smart people and not start to think, oh my God, they're probably right about this. Like they know something about this. So it's been a really great experience. And I would say Bitcoin, like buy a dollar's worth. You can go to swanbitcoin.com/Natalie Brunel and read The Bitcoin Standard and listen to my podcast and you'll learn a lot.
Amazing. I'm going to do all those things because I want to know more. I want to be more informed, but it's one of those things where you don't necessarily know where to start.
Yeah, it is. It's a really big rabbit hole and it can be intimidating. And I think, again, like, you know, find someone that you look up to in the space and connect with them and follow them and just start digging in. YouTube is great for this, podcasts are great too.
What is something that you would tell 20-year-old Natalie?
Oh my gosh. I on a career level, since we've talked a lot about the career, I actually wish that I had maybe pursued something like, I was always fascinated by different aspects of different industries. Like I at one point really was fascinated by health. I thought about being a doctor, and obviously economics is something I'm really passionate about. In news, you're sort of like a jack of all trades, where you never go too deep on one thing. So you see sort of surface of everything, and you have to cover a fire one day and public policy the next, and an entertainment event the next, and it's just like a hodgepodge. I didn't know that the industry would go in the direction that it did with social media and sort of this idea of becoming an expert and being able to market your expertise. So if I was 20 again, I would actually hone in on one thing. I would hone in on one thing that I was really passionate about, whether it was investigative reporting or health or economics. I would learn everything I could about that. Whatever, fashion, sports, I don't know what your listeners are interested in, but like I would hone in on one thing and become an expert in that and be a source that people could go to for that type of information or content. And I would put out content and I would, put myself out there as a person within that, specific genre or space, which I think I'm doing now with.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what you're doing now.
Yeah. And honestly, like I'm so much happier. Yeah. I think, sometimes we try to pursue too many masters, right? And we're just like, we're all over the place and we lack a little bit of focus. And I also think that sometimes we limit ourselves with what we're capable of and of our dreams. And, I see this with my students sometimes, like they're really passionate maybe about entertainment or something. And they feel like they have to be going and reporting on the political stuff. And it's like, well, you don't have to be. And the industry's changed a lot. So go to the job that will make you happy and will build your expertise in whatever you love, because if there's passion, there's going to be success ultimately, because you're not even going to feel like you're working. Like, I don't feel like I'm working anymore. I feel like I'm just spreading the message on something I truly believe can change people's lives and that will change our future. So I really urge people to find something that they're passionate about and focus, and make that your mission.
I love that. I couldn't agree more. The landscape of media has changed so much since I got out of college. I got out of college in 2014. And there was Instagram was there and Twitter was there, but it wasn't there how it is today. And there's so much space. Now we have TikTok. We have people reporting about Gabby Petito on TikTok. And it's just like, I never would have believed that, as I was studying journalism in college. I just never would have.
I know, it's so different. If you would have given me a crystal ball, I don't know if I would have even majored in journalism, right? I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's changed a lot since the days that I was looking at Barbara Walters interviews, that's for sure.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. What is something that you've done or accomplished that you're really proud of, personally, professionally, and just something you want to toot your horn about?
Oh gosh, I'm really proud that my investigative reporting was nominated for an Emmy twice. And I actually have my name on an Emmy for breaking news. So that was a really nice accomplishment. I don't know. It's something random that I'm really proud of. I grew up dancing. I love dancing. That's like just a side hobby passion of mine. And when I was living in Palm Springs, there was this like local charity version of Dancing with the Stars. It was called Dancing with the Desert Stars. And I was like, I absolutely have to be in this. And so I competed and I won. So they like have this like mirror ball trophy that they made for me. And it was so much fun. And I got to do the salsa and perform in front of this big crowd. And we raised $100,000 for charity. And it was just like such a fun experience. And like, I'm really proud because I was older by that point. I hadn't taken dance classes in forever. And I just like got up there and I worked it and it was fun.
Oh my gosh. I love that. That is amazing.
Yeah, it was fun.
All the kudos to you. Incredible. What is your big goal for, you know, Bitcoin and what you're creating? And as you're obviously, I think your vision has changed. You said Barbara Walters, maybe that was the vision when you were younger, but what's your ultimate vision now? And maybe it's still progressing.
Yeah, so that's a great question. My vision for my future has constantly evolved because of how much our industry evolves. So now I would say it's twofold. I want to spread the word on Bitcoin to like the average, you know, the general public that was my audience before, but just doesn't understand the technology or has some questions about it. I'd love to simplify the message and work in a capacity that's more on my terms, where I like now that I sort of, you know, call the shots and I'm my own boss and I'm engaging in opportunities that allow me to teach people about Bitcoin and talk about Bitcoin using my background. And then my other vision is I really want to have a family. And I'm at that point now where I dedicated my 20s to building my career and setting up a foundation on that front. And now I would love to have a family and settle down and have children that I provide a life to the way my parents did. And yeah, I'm just looking for more of that connection. So I look forward to when that happens.
Beautiful. Tell everyone where they can find you, anywhere you want to be found. Definitely tell us, you know, podcast, Instagram, anywhere you want to be found, tell us all about it.
Yeah, please download my podcast. You can find it on all the podcast platforms as well as on YouTube. It's Coin Stories. And you can search Coin Stories or my name, Natalie Brunel. On Twitter, I'm at Nat Brunel. On Instagram, I'm Natalie Brunel. And, you know, please feel free to reach out. I respond to DMs and I'd love to connect. And I'm going to be holding some upcoming webinars and just opportunities for people to learn more about Bitcoin if they want to. So you'll have to stay tuned for my posts for that. So thank you for having me.
Yay. I love that. Thank you so much. And be on behalf of women all over the world, thank you for being a woman in this space and just, you know, being there for us. Cause it really does help to have someone that looks like you talking to me about money rather than, like I said, some old crusty white guy. So thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for what you do as well.
That was TV correspondent, Emmy award-winning journalist and podcaster, Natalie Brunel. For more information on Natalie and all of our past guests here on the show, please go to carriegillespie.com. If you enjoyed today's episode and are enjoying the show in general, it would mean the absolute world to me if you took a spare moment and went to Apple Podcasts, wrote the show a 5-star review. It is so, so helpful. It helps the show grow, helps give me feedback about what you like, and it's just really the currency of the podcasting world that we live in. So it would mean the world to me if you just had a spare moment. I swear it takes 10 seconds. Go leave that review right now. You can keep up with me in daily life on Instagram. I am at carrie.gillespie and the show is at Candid with Carrie. Thanks so much for joining me this week, you guys. I love you so much for being a part of this community. I can't wait to chat with you again next week. In the meantime, make good choices and be kind to others. Bye, guys.